Before we jump into this week's episode, I just want to take a second to plug a really exciting event we have coming to kick off a first-of-its-kind series in the San Diego area. We are launching a lecture series, Talking San Diego, that will feature live conversations with some of the most prominent figures in the country. We plan in coming years to bring to Southern California a great set of the most interesting political figures, authors of important new books, public intellectuals, and out-of-the-box thinkers and performers. And I feel so honored to have as our first guest for Talking San Diego, a friend of the pod, constitutional law professor, a prominent congressman, and most notably, a tireless warrior for constitutionalism and the rule of law, Representative Jamie Raskin. Congressman Raskin will be joining me in conversation at UCSD's new downtown building at Park and Market on Monday, March 18th at 2 o'clock. If you or someone you know in the region would be interested in purchasing a ticket, which are going fast, or want to learn more about the upcoming events for Talking San Diego, please visit talkingsandiego.net. or click the link in the description of this episode. That's talkingsandiego.net. All right, on with this week's episode.
My purpose tonight is to wake up the Congress and alert the American people that this is no ordinary moment either. Not since President Lincoln and the Civil War have freedom and democracy been under assault at home as they are today. What makes our moment rare is that freedom and democracy are under attack at both at home and overseas at the very same time.
Welcome to Talking Feds, a roundtable that brings together prominent former federal officials and special guests for a dynamic discussion of the most important political and legal topics of the day. I'm Harry Littman. We are abruptly on the other side. With the demolition of the Haley campaign and a rousing State of the Union that was more a campaign kickoff, we are now at the starting line for arguably the most important general presidential election since the Civil War. The results of Super Tuesday, a rout for Donald Trump, left Nikki Haley with no real option but to fold her tent and drove home the sobering fact that the Republican Party has chosen as its standard bearer the only president ever to resist the peaceful transfer of power. 2 days after Super Tuesday, President Biden, plagued by widespread doubts about his age and vitality, came through on the biggest speech of his career with a pitch-perfect appeal to voters and a sharp demarcation of the difference between him and the man he referred to as his predecessor. Biden followed up with a spring-in-his-step campaign stop in Pennsylvania that, for the moment, went a long way toward allaying the fears of the party faithful. The rematch between Biden and Trump served to sharpen the stakes of Trump's long list of legal perils and make his overall strategy of stalling until after November a matter of historic importance. On that front, Trump again profited from the indulgence of Judge Eileen Cannon in the Mar-a-Lago case, while the two other major criminal cases were both stuck in a sort of legal quicksand. That still leaves the first criminal trial ever against a former president in New York State Court, which is on track to begin in 2 weeks. To take stock of big developments this week that bring us to the starting line of the 2024 general election, we have a stellar group of reporters and political analysts, all returning Talking Feds favorites, who are preparing not to sleep very much between now and November. And they are Robert Costa, the chief election and campaign correspondent for CBS News. He co-authored the New York Times bestseller, Peril, with Bob Woodward, which we covered as part of our Talking Books series. Great to see you, Robert, and thanks for returning.
Great to be back with you.
Hugo Lowell, a political investigations reporter at The Guardian covering Donald Trump and the Justice Department. Thanks for being here, Hugo.
Thanks. Happy to be here.
And Tara Settmeyer, a senior advisor for the Lincoln Project and co-host of The Breakdown with The Rick Wilson. Always great to have you at the table. Thanks so much, Tara Settmeyer.
Glad to be back.
All right, so it is the day after Joe Biden's State of the Union, and the feeling is palpable that since 24 hours ago, we've cleared up the path and the horn is sounding to announce the beginning of the general election. Let's talk about the speech itself. I don't think it's an exaggeration to say it was the most important speech of his life. Maybe not an exaggeration to say the best one he's ever given, but how will it go down in the annals? So let me begin with Tara. You said in the immediate aftermath that Biden came to kick ass and take names, and that's exactly what he did. What'd you see as his sort of precise goals, Tara, and why did he achieve them so impressively in your view?
Yeah, I'm with you that I felt that the stakes were incredibly high for Biden in this speech, and it was probably the most important political speech of his career, given all of the conversations around his age and his mental acuity and all of this. And I said, okay, here we go. When I worked in Capitol Hill, I went to 7 State of the Union addresses, and so I pay very close attention to the pomp and circumstance around it, but also the presentation. And oftentimes, they're sleepy addresses, no pun intended with the Joe Biden reference, but oftentimes, no one remembers the State of the Union unless there's a moment. And there have been moments in past State of the Union addresses that have stood out, and not because of policy. It's usually some type of either a gaffe or heckling now seems to be a regular state of affairs, a modus operandi for Republicans. And in the era of Donald Trump, everyone kind of would always cringe. Will he stay on message? Is he going to read the prompter? What's going to happen? With Joe Biden this time, I could tell from the time he walked in the chamber that he was hyped up and ready to go. You could see through the screen that the crowd was electric. Democrats got the memo to make sure that they had enthusiasm and energy. And President Biden feeds off of that. He is a classic retail politician. So from the very beginning, I felt pretty good about where this was going to go. Within the first 5 to 7 minutes, I was floored at how aggressively he knocked it out of the park on issues that I think are critically important to the future of this country, whether it was democracy in January 6th, whether it was the importance of supporting Ukraine, not bowing down to Putin. And he was feeling it. And he kept that energy up throughout the majority of the speech, which is not easy to do. And I thought that he overexceeded and put to rest any questions about his ability to do the job, not only on the part of Democrats who were bedwetting a bit about this in his age, but I think that a lot of what he said would resonate with people who are in the middle that are uncomfortable with Donald Trump and really don't want another 4 years of him and started to feel a bit more comfortable perhaps voting for Joe Biden this time around, given what's at stake. I thought it was a great opening shot.
It really did. I haven't attended 7, but I've watched more than my share, and they always seem to have these meandering, long, boring parts with policy proposals. I was really struck at the deftness with which he wove in the individual policy aspects with drawing contrast with Trump, with his overall delivery. Not easy, I think, being aggressive but not angry. He's sometimes too low-key. He really did seem to just make really good contact at kind of every turn. And, you know, this from a president not known for his speech-making skills. Hugo, Robert, were you surprised?
I thought it was objectively a good speech, right? I think Biden had to rise to the moment, and it's been a really rough 6 months for him in terms of headlines, especially the one that keeps getting talked over and over again about, you know, people in Trump's circle is when he had that press conference at the White House and he confused Mexican president with Egyptian president when he was talking about Israel. And I think there was a real risk that if he didn't step up to the plate yesterday night, that would be the perception of voters going forward. I think if there was ever a moment or ever a speech that could reset that narrative, it was yesterday. I think the way he was animated was a Biden that I hadn't previously seen. You know, I don't cover the White House day in, day out, but I was there when Biden announced the withdrawal of US forces in Afghanistan. And when I saw him in person there, I thought, wow, this guy is frail. And then if you contrast that to how he was yesterday night, and he had these like zingers, and he was going after the justices, and the justices were, you know, really put up when he was bringing up the Roe v. Wade decision. That was a Biden that I had not previously seen. And I think that was the reset that he needed.
For President Biden, this was a crucial speech at a critical moment in his presidency. So many Democrats behind the scenes for weeks have grown worried about the latest polling in the 2024 presidential race, seeing former President Donald Trump gallop ahead in certain surveys. And that was part of the context heading into the evening. Another part of the context was the State of the Union took place just days after Super Tuesday, when Trump all but swept across Republican contests and sewed up the nomination, or came close to doing so. And what was most intriguing to me as a reporter was hearing what President Biden put at the top of the speech, an overture to traditional Republicans, especially on foreign policy, quoting the late Ronald Reagan, saying that there is a place in the Democratic coalition, the Biden coalition, for Republicans who supported Haley, who supported Reagan, who might be averse to Trump due to his character and conduct, and his view on foreign policy, the embrace of Hungarian leader Viktor Orban, who Trump's meeting with, as well as the rampant nationalism that's coursing through the GOP. So for Biden, this was not only a reset as the campaign kicks off into the general election season, it was also an opportunity for him to both reassure progressives and those critical of his own foreign policy on the left, but also try to make some inroads with centrist, independent Republican voters as Trump's about to face a criminal trial in New York, and as Nikki Haley voters wonder if there's really a place for them in the Trump Republican Party.
That was on purpose for them to do that early on, because Donald Trump has made it clear on more than one occasion that Haley voters and moderate Republicans are not welcome in the MAGA Republican Party. He put it on his Truth Social. He said a couple months ago that if you donate to Haley's campaign, you're cast out of MAGA. And then he also recently said in the last week that they're purging the party of the Romneys of the party. This is a MAGA party. So it was really smart after Super Tuesday for President Biden to come out and put that statement to say, hey, there's a place for you here. We welcome you in, because it has not been an insignificant amount of Republicans that did not vote for Donald Trump in the primaries. And the Biden camp understands that. So they were very smart to invoke Reagan in the beginning. Those are people at the Lincoln Project. We call them Red Dawn dads, or, you know, Red Dawn voters, because they're these traditional muscular foreign policy, like Reaganite folks that are not comfortable with Donald Trump's position, being friendly with Putin and dictators and things. So where do they go? And, you know, Joe Biden is never, he's never been a dove, really. He comes from a pretty hawkish, old school blue dog Democrat party. And that was a smart thing to do to appeal to those folks. And he believes it, which makes it more convincing. He does believe in that. And also to watch the Republican reaction, sitting on their hands, looking down when Reagan and freedom and democracy around the world is invoked, that's not something that Republicans can stand up and clap for anymore. The Republican reaction to some of those things that were bipartisan overtures in the past, and watching them sit on their hands and look down, look away, or scowl was really telling about where the future of the Republican Party is going.
Yeah, I think that was a really important moment. I just want to agree, especially on this first 5 to 7 moments, so adroitly crafted. And the Haley point, it's a genuine dilemma for them, because Trump has been so vehement, and it's so much his brand to shun anyone who doesn't play by his own terms. But for cash and numbers, they are going to need her. I was struck, Robert, I take the point that in this 5 or 7 minutes, he gave different overtures. The same thing happened in immigration. But he also took it to them in a way that surprised me. So he criticized Trump, but he also said, and many here in the chambers basically denied the truth about January 6th. And there was a lot of sitting on their hands. It would have been a very interesting exercise to just watch this with noise off and just watch Republicans and then the counter speech at the end, which did seem, all of it, pretty glum and low energy. But what about the point of going after not just Trump, but the party? Is that a theme we're going to see in the campaign?
My assessment would be that last year and this year, the two most revealing moments in Biden's State of the Unions have come off script. Last year, it was the exchange with shouting congressional Republicans. And this year in particular, it was not just him clashing on the issues of January 6th and other issues. It was his impromptu exchange with Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene of Georgia, who he initially encountered as he walked into the chamber. She was wearing that bright red MAGA cap, and she wanted to hand him a pin that had the name of the young woman in Georgia who was horrifically murdered, Lachlan Riley. And Biden took the pin up with him to the lectern for the State of the Union. And during the course of the speech, as we all saw, Marjorie Taylor Greene starts to kind of shout, say her name. And Biden, instead of shrugging her off and ignoring her, shouted, please. He instead chooses to have an impromptu exchange with her. And while some Democrats are very unhappy that President Biden used a term to describe undocumented migrants that they would never use in terms of crossings that are not under the rule of law, he was able to tackle the issue of border security in a way that addressed one of the most sensitive issues he faces in this campaign, is how is he going to handle the different challenges at the border? And he was able to use that exchange to kind of put it right back in the face of Trump-aligned Republicans like Green and say, we have a bill. James Lankford in the Senate, a Republican, has outlined a bill along with Democrats. There's legislation here. I want to get something done. And then he said the name of the woman killed and expressed sympathy to her families, noted that he himself has dealt with the death of children. And so for Biden, it was a chance to humanize and bring kind of his political spirit into one of the trickiest areas of this campaign for him, which is the border. So many voters I've encountered over the past year raised that issue as one of real concern for them, whether they're right, left, or center. And for Biden, addressing Green, it really shows he's not afraid to take it on. And that might have some political reverberations down the line for voters who wonder if he was really willing to address it at all.
And it didn't hurt that Lankford, in an aside, was heard to concur with his assessment that it is a pretty good bill. I totally agree. And those moments, as Tara was saying, you know, they stand out. And in his case in particular, because those impromptu moments, I think of Clinton in 98 with my fellow Republicans, They show vitality. So in that sense also, it wasn't just the rhetorical point, but this overall question. Let me ask this, because the whispers and ruminations have been really strong, as you said. I remember in 1984, I'm showing my age, where Reagan faced the same charge and told Mondale in a debate, I'm not going to make an issue of the youth and inexperience of my opponent. And that was kind of it.
He said he wouldn't hold it against him.
Yeah. But that's too much for Biden and the Democrats to hope for. Yeah. I mean, he had a very strong night and more people were paying attention. But it's not as if this age and vitality issue now go away, right?
Well, it's not going to go away because he's not going to get any younger, right? I mean, it's obvious we're looking at an elderly man, but so is Donald Trump. And I think that the Trump campaign always projects what they fear or what they're doing. And the fact that the Trump camp decided to put out a political ad for 24 hours going after Biden as feeble and questioning his ability to do the job, would he even make it through his term and all of that, fell flat. And that's what Republicans were hoping for, that, oh, you know, Biden's going to have a misstep, he's going to have a sleepy speech or whatever. And that was blown out of the water. So as long as Biden doesn't have too many gaffes, you know, as long as he doesn't fall down or things like that, I think that they're not going to keep being able to just rely on that, because it's going to be baked into the cake, because his opponent is old also and wears makeup and looks ridiculous to try to hide his age and the fact that he's not healthy. Joe Biden is fit as a fiddle. He looks good and he wears suits that actually fit him. And so you want to put them, that image, side by side. You know, I look forward to that Joe Biden on the debate stage next to Donald Trump come the fall, if Donald Trump even will debate.
which he surprisingly says he wants to. What is then, you're the Machiavellian Republican, you're watching this speech, you know he's had a good night, your party has had a bad night. Is there anything that he said that you think they can try to turn around to their advantage, notwithstanding how solid his marks are?
Oh, they're going to keep the drumbeat. That's what they've done. It doesn't matter whether it's true or not. They just create the perception. They've already started hitting him on immigration. You saw what the response was, that god-awful, very creepy, weird Republican response. But it's already baked in. That's why they don't want to solve the immigration issue. That's why it was tanked in the House. And I'm so glad that President Biden called him to the carpet on that and said, even by name, like, oh, so you guys are against the bill that your conservatives negotiated? Oh, okay. Oh, I know you can read what's in it. Here's what's in it. So you're against that? That was great. So it puts them on their heels a little bit, but it doesn't matter. They're still going to go and yell into their echo chamber to their people. Their people are unmovable. They're convinced that this is only going to be solved by Donald Trump. Now, this has been an area of legit criticism for them. They have not handled it well. But now they have a bill, a bipartisan one, and he needs to go on offense and put it on Republicans to explain why wouldn't you want to help solve this? And the answer is because Donald Trump doesn't want them to. And that's a great campaign issue as far as I'm concerned. Keep going on offense, offense, offense. Republicans are going to try and convince people that no, it's not our fault, it's his. But it makes it a little harder for the people that Biden needs to win over. We have to remember, Biden doesn't need to win over MAGA people. He needs to win over the middle of the road folks in five states. That's it.
That's so the key point again and again and again. So let me zero in from that vantage point and ask, you know, are we suffering from a little bit of myopia, both in terms of whom we're looking at and the impact? Because were the people that Tara mentions, whom the election really does come down to, were they listening? Have they tuned in yet? And will the afterglow from the speech fade pretty quickly, or will it serve to sort of define a new default set of perceptions about Biden and the Democrats?
The State of the Union has not always been a high stakes or high profile affair. I always think about the famous decision by President Thomas Jefferson in 1801 to send a letter to Congress instead of making an appearance. And the Constitution, as you know, Harry, more than anyone, says from time to time, the language in the Constitution says the president might address Congress, but there's no requirement to do so. And so it's become only in really the past century something that's a political and media moment as much as an agenda setting moment. And President Biden, though, I think this was really important for him because he is so unlike his predecessor, as he would call Trump, in terms of using the public space, headlines, news to drive coverage and interest in his presidency. It has to be one of the most low-key presidencies I've ever covered in the past two decades, even though he's done a lot, domestic and foreign policy-wise. But as a reporter, I would say Trump always had this ability, when I covered his presidency, to almost dive into the news cycle and create waves. Biden is much more of a traditional president. And so many voters I've met over the past year working for CBS, they don't really follow Biden day to day in the same way you almost had to follow Trump day to day, because it was like a new episode, drama, controversy, scandal. So the State of the Union for Biden was a chance to reintroduce himself to the country, go over what he's done, but also remind them of his vigor, even though he's over the age of 80, that he has energy and that he has an agenda and he's willing to take on Trump. Most people aren't paying attention to Biden every day. This was a time for Biden to get everybody's attention and have Trump off stage, a rare kind of dynamic for Biden, and he clearly took advantage of it.
Robert, in particular, the sort of very small cadre of swing voters who, whatever happens between now and November, are going to be the ones who decide?
Well, I don't think the swing voter this time is going to be what we think of as the swing voter. Yes, traditional Republicans in the suburbs always are important and might be willing to change to the Democrats this time around. But the swing voter I'm paying attention to is the union voter. And I recently had a brief interview with President Biden, a long interview with Sean Fain, the head of the UAW, who was there last night with First Lady Jill Biden, to talk about labor issues. And you heard in the speech Biden take on corporate America, talk again and again about unions. He knows that on issues like immigration and the economy, union voters are listening to Trump. And they're really giving Trump a hearing. even though the UAW and other unions have endorsed Biden. So Biden's not taking union support for granted. That, to me, is the swing vote. Union voters in southwestern Pennsylvania, Detroit, Michigan, and the suburbs of Detroit, Wisconsin, those are the voters who might decide who wins the industrial Midwest and thus the White House.
I mean, I do think successful speeches like this just somehow get in the water and change the overall stakes of what each candidate has to achieve. But there's no overemphasizing these cadres, these pockets of people, including from my own southwestern Pennsylvania. Do you feel that the speech hits home there as well, or are they not paying attention yet?
Yeah, I'm a little more skeptical about how long the half-life of this speech is. You know, if you think about it, we're in March, the election's 6, 7, 8 months away, and the next few months are going to be dominated by a lot of Trump's criminal cases or whatever other news that fills between now and then. I don't know if one good speech, as excellent as it was, is going to carry through to voters in November. I just feel like the news cycle's moved quicker now. The one thing that I would come back to with Trump, for instance, was when he met with the white nationalist Nick Fuentes at Mar-a-Lago. And at the time, it was huge. Like MSNBC and CNN and like the cable networks like ran with it for, what was it, like a week and a half? It was over and over again. I don't know if people even remember that, you know, or remembered that 6 months later. It kind of got swallowed up by everything else that happened in the meantime. And I don't know, I guess I'm just skeptical that that speech, that, you know, one good speech will carry through as strongly as the Biden team wants. I also think Biden has been trying increasingly to reach young voters through TikTok or YouTube or like little clips. I did think last night that the speech wasn't a very clippable speech. There are a lot of interactions that played off with Marjorie Taylor Greene, for instance. But if you know, if you're a really, you know, casual follower of politics, would you really understand the significance of that? You know, for us, sure. But if I went and asked my, you know, 23-year-old friend who's an associate at UBS, would he have any conception of what that meant or the significance of the moment? Like, I don't think so. And so I think there are some limitations to that because the State of the Union is a speech carried on TV. And increasingly, I don't know how many people watch TV.
That's because the speech wasn't targeted to them. And they will use their surrogates and parts of what the Biden agenda is to go out there and talk to those 23-year-olds because they don't watch TV, right? And to your point, right, you're looking for a clippable thing. Okay, what they'll see is that he was energetic and that he took it to the Republicans. Okay, great. But they're not really paying attention. That demographic, they're not paying attention now. They'll pay attention in the fall. After the summer and people now it's, you know, oh, an election is, oh yeah, okay. So that's not really who they were targeting for the State of the Union. And they were using it, and people, some of the criticism has been, oh, it was a highly political speech and it was like a campaign speech, blah, blah, blah. Well, you know what? The conventional wisdom on a lot of things are out the door. And they needed to take advantage of the bully pulpit that they had to reset the campaign. They have to. They had to start going by a different set of rules because the Republicans are not going by the same rules. And we often say at the Lincoln Project, you have to play the game you're in, not the game you wish you were in or the game you're used to. You have to play the game you're in. And going a bit off script in the, you know, normal way that State of the Unions happen, I think was a sign that the Biden camp is finally realizing that they have to be more aggressive on this and take advantage of every opportunity they have. So this is just the opening salvo. Of course, no one's going to remember the State of the Union in 6 months from now, but this gives them a really strong foundation to build upon moving forward. So they've got to start setting the narrative now.
I'll give you one clippable 23-year-old moment, which is the Supreme Court. That really called them out.
That was clippable. That was clippable, Hugo.
Yeah, totally clippable. And I'm just thinking that the way these things work, you guys all know better than I, but it's less, you know, that he made the point about they should support immigration and more just the overall feel that gets in the water and trickles down to the younger voters who are kind of a mystery in all cycles to me. Let's just end with this. So now, just as you say, they're going to try to harness this momentum and fan out and have surrogates as well as Biden carry a message. What's the kind of marching orders that the surrogates who are taking it to the rest of the nation and especially the swing states are being told to emphasize as they kind of hit the hustings?
Well, I think for sure they need to remind people of the accomplishments. Joe Biden legislatively has had significant accomplishments in his first term as president, things that Donald Trump was unable to accomplish, mainly infrastructure. And that is the shovel-ready jobs type of thing. People actually feel that in their communities. And Biden referred to that at another unscripted moment with Republicans during the speech, where he's like, yeah, I know you guys voted against it, but you were happy to take the money and show up at the ceremony when right. when the projects are ready to go, right? I think he needs to do more of that. They've got to get him on the road and his cabinet secretaries on the road showing people this is what Joe Biden has done. I heard the DNC chairman, Jamie Harrison, the other night go down a list of accomplishments and said, Joe Biden did that. Joe Biden did that. And people need to know that he's done this for you, for our country. So that's going to be the marching order, and also just the comparing and contrasting between President Biden's vision for the future of this country versus Donald Trump's. The contrast is stark, and people need to understand what the consequences would be of an America under Donald Trump's watch again. I don't think they fully have grasped that yet, but that'll be a little bit later.
We really need to prepare for the general election heating up. You have a rematch that we've all seen coming, but now it's coming into form. And it's going to be rough and tumble in ways I think we can't even imagine. On the precipice now is Trump sitting in a courtroom as required by law for 6 weeks, then the tumult of a Supreme Court decision on presidential immunity come late April or likely in May or June, and then the huge crossroads of whether Judge Chutkan in the January 6th Washington, D.C. trial or the classified documents case in Florida, whether they even go forward as trials before the election. So many variables in this campaign. Yes, it's a rematch. Yes, it's the same two candidates. But Trump's legal challenges, which Hugo has covered so well, and Harry, you've helped us out at CBS News, these are huge issues that have no real certainty as part of the calculation.
Or precedent, right?
Right.
All right. Let's leave that for now and go to the other side of the aisle, which was even more definitive with Trump's route in Super Tuesday. So we really are now at the, you know, jump ball for the general election. Let's start with Haley's hanging around as long as she did. It seemed quixotic, but what was her strategy for staying in as long as she did, and was it accomplished?
Well, staying in as long as she did because she had the money to do it. And Super Tuesday was pretty much the final horizon for her because there was just so many delegates to be won there that there would be no possible way for her to overtake Trump once Super Tuesday happened. So she was able to point to that she was the first woman Republican presidential candidate to win delegates, right? I mean, DC and Vermont, okay, good for you. You can put that as a notch in your belt for history. Insignificant in the greater scheme of things. The reason why she didn't endorse Trump right away, which I firmly believe she will eventually endorse him, but she didn't do it right away because she has relevance and power now, because her voters, her people are valuable. They need them. And Susie Wiles and Chris LaCivita, who run Trump's campaign now, they're very seasoned Republican operatives. They actually do know what they're doing. They understand that they need those voters. Now, whether Trump has the discipline to try to bring them back in is another question. Like we said earlier, he hasn't demonstrated that so far. He's done nothing but insult them. What they put forward as a strategy versus what Trump actually does are two completely different things, so we shall see. But they recognize that they need these folks because Donald Trump has a smaller universe of voters to draw from than Joe Biden does. Elections are a game of numbers. So we'll see. I'll be very curious to see what Nikki Haley ultimately does and when, because she has to make a decision what her future is. If she thinks she wants to have any future in today, this current Republican Party, she's going to have to bow down to Trump and endorse him eventually. But she'll probably wait till closer to the convention, because she will not speak at the convention otherwise.
Let me focus on this current party. You know, Robert, you said It's not the end of the road for Haley. She wants to continue playing a pivotal role in Republican politics and policies. But, you know, Trump is almost defined by his kind of vengeance and viciousness. Does that ambition translate into something current? Or are you saying that whenever the Republican Party rises from the ashes of Trump, then she'll be there? Or do you think her play is for current relevancy?
Harry, I would say it's all of the above. She suspended her campaign, so there's the remote possibility that she could always restart it without having to do a whole new filing. And she can continue to raise money to pay off debts legally. So she's in suspended mode, but with all the legal stuff we've detailed that could be coming for Trump, she's standing there as someone who hasn't won a ton of delegates, but has won more delegates than anyone else beyond Trump in the race, winning Vermont, winning the District of Columbia, collecting some delegates in other states. So she enters the Republican National Convention in Milwaukee this summer with some political capital. And the question is going to be, what does she want to do with that political capital? Can she cut a deal with the Trump campaign to get a primetime speaking slot at the convention, a major, major primetime opportunity? Or maybe Trump just tries to keep her off stage and she has to stay on the sidelines. It's all going to have to do with how she plays her endorsement, if she endorses at all. And it's a complicated play. I think back to 2016, Senator Ted Cruz did pretty well in the primary race against Trump and kind of gave a half-hearted endorsement of him at the convention, but said, vote your conscience, and set him on a tough path with Trump for a while. But eventually he came around. She needs to decide, does she really want to be a Trump antagonist, or does she want to just make a play for 28 by playing it cool in 2024?
Ted Cruz got booed, just to remind everyone. I was there and it was very uncomfortable. He got booed, and the party is way more MAGA now than it was in the summer of 2016. So Nikki Haley needs to decide, does she want to go through that humiliation? Because Trump would relish in that. He loves to humiliate people. And I think that she's in a unique position to come out on top of this if she does not bend the knee. That was part of the appeal. You talk to people, and I'm sure Hugo and Bob, you guys know, if you talk to people about why they supported her and wanted her to stay in the race, it's because she was taking it to him, finally, in my opinion, way too late in the game, and only after he insulted her husband. But, you know, she finally was hitting him back and people appreciated that. So she goes now and then capitulates to him. Where does she have any credibility with who? MAGA's never going to love her.
And when can she then like shake it off in 28?
No.
Also, an unusual position for Trump. Maybe, you know, they're really cash strapped and they need her donors. Do you have a sense of sort of who needs the other more? I guess you often throw out the playbook with Trump, but what is the standard political playbook after the, you know, bitterness of these last few weeks and Trump in particular drawing a line in the sand about, you know, anyone who supports her at all?
Well, the line from inside Trump's circle, as far as we have reported, is Trump sees no return path for Haley. And she stayed in the race too long, hit him too hard. And, you know, I think his advisors are like, look, it's not just us. The MAGA base isn't going to take her back. Like she did it for too long. You know, if she had dropped out maybe when DeSantis did, then he would still have credibility inside the Republican Party today leading into the convention. But because she hasn't, and because Trump's, I think, hatred of her is so vitriolic, the epithet that we hear bandied around Haley is a pejorative phrase that rhymes with bunt. It's really strong. And so this is what I guess is tricky to figure out, is how much can Trump put his personal animosity towards Haley aside and try and build a bridge if he needs to, whether it's for the money or whether it's for the voters, because he really needs it. And I think, you know, Susie and Chris, to Tara's point, may well be telling him that. But it's very difficult to get Trump to do something he doesn't want to do. And I think he feels that Haley was so disloyal, he doesn't see a way back for her. And I think that's pretty significant.
Why would she even want one? You know what I mean? Like, he's insulted her, went after her husband, calls her a bird brain. I mean, incredibly, incredibly disrespectful. Now, Ted Cruz and Lindsey Graham, and all the rest of them, Mitch McConnell, they have no honor. They didn't stand up for their spouses when Trump went after them. or them personally, and they still bowed the knee for political expediency, which is just despicable and why people hate politics. So Nikki Haley is in a position where if she were to endorse him, I think that just would speak volumes about her character. And it would be so incredibly embarrassing for her that I hope she doesn't for her sake. There's life after politics. Like, do you have to debase yourself that much? We've seen every single person who's ever done this for Trump has not come out on the winning end.
Yeah, never. Mitt Romney, right? He can't humiliate them enough. There's life after politics. There's also politics after politics. I mean, it's anyone's calculation how long Trump stays dominant, but there will be some vestiges, Liz Cheney and others, to sort of inherit the mantle such as it is. All right, let's close out with this thought. So it seems like it's going to be a hard play given the personalities involved for there to be a kiss and make up session. So to the extent her campaign exposed some potential weaknesses for Trump, maybe affluent or highly educated Republicans, does Biden have a play for capitalizing on those weaknesses? If Trump continues to shun Haley and Haley supporters, is there a viable opening for Biden and the Dems, or are these pretty much lost causes, even if they don't embrace Trump?
I think Biden is making it clear he wants to make an explicit play for Haley voters and traditional Republicans. The day after Haley got out,
the president put a statement out there ahead of the State of the Union saying he wants Haley voters. He's reaching out to them. He respects Haley's campaign. And what we're really going to be watching now at CBS is, does Trump start to make any changes in his campaign for the general election or not? And so many people who have known Trump for years tell me Trump can't change. He won't change.
Right.
In fact,
right.
He wants to dig deeper into his MAGA personality, his MAGA base, and just hope that that all is enough to win the White House. And look, the Republican Party is falling in line. Trump's taking control of the Republican National Committee this week. And I think the vice presidential pick more than ever is going to matter since Trump's 77 years old. If he picks Marjorie Taylor Greene versus someone like Doug Burgum, the governor of North Dakota, it's just going to be really interesting. Does he pick a kind of Mike Pence or Nikki Haley type, or does he pick a Marjorie Taylor Greene type?
It's now time to take a moment for our sidebar feature, which explains some of the issues that are prominent in the news. Today's sidebar is about the Family and Medical Leave Act, an act that provides protection against termination for employees who take significant unpaid time off due to serious personal circumstances. To explain and answer this question, we welcome Claudia Rankin. Claudia is a poet, essayist, playwright, and the editor of several anthologies. She's the author of 5 volumes of poetry, 3 plays, and various essays. Among her numerous awards and honors, Claudia is the recipient of the Bobbitt National Prize for Poetry, the Poets and Writers Jackson Poetry Prize, and fellowships from the Guggenheim Foundation, the Lannan Foundation, the MacArthur Foundation, United States Artists, and the National Endowment of the Arts. And with that, I give you Claudia Rankin on the Family and Medical Leave Act.
In 1993, Bill Clinton signed the Family and Medical Leave Act of 1993, or the FMLA. The act provides protection against termination for employees who take significant unpaid time off due to serious personal circumstances. Employees may take off 12 weeks in a 12-month period for purposes: the birth of a child, recovery from a serious illness, assisting a spouse, child, or parent with a serious illness. The Act gives these employees the right to retain their health insurance and employment benefits, as well as the right to return to their position or a comparable position after the leave. It also protects employees from retaliation by employers for having taken leave. Eligible employees include both public and private sector workers. Generally, an employee becomes eligible after 12 months of employment, including working 1,250 hours with that employer in the past 12 months. The federal law does not protect employees of businesses who employ 50 or fewer workers in a 75-mile radius. Some employees, such as elected officials, are not protected or have limited protections. There are significant differences to these regulations in many states. Many states have lowered the number of employees at a business required for the protections. Others have expanded the protections to include care for grandparents or civil union partners. The act was a major element of President Clinton's early domestic agenda. His 1992 campaign emphasized President H.W. Bush's vetoes against previous family leave acts. As more and more women entered the workforce, such protections became increasingly important. The Pregnancy Discrimination Act of 1978 aimed to curb rampant discriminatory practices against women in the workforce. While the act helped to limit discrimination against women in relation to their pay, employability, access to promotions, and other aspects of professional life during or immediately after pregnancy-related medical issues, it did not protect women who needed to take time off to care for children or other family members otherwise. With expectations for different gender roles still dominant, in 1992, women faced higher risk of discrimination for taking time off to care for family. While the act is gender neutral and is used by both men and women, it was regarded as a landmark protection for women in the workforce. For Talking Feds, I'm Claudia Rankin.
Thank you, Claudia Rankin. Claudia's recent collection of essays, Just Us, An American Conversation, is available for purchase at Barnes & Noble and Amazon.
All right, it is now time for a spirited debate brought to you by our sponsor, Total Wine & More. Each episode, you'll be hearing an expert talk about the pros and cons of a particular issue in the world of wine, spirit, and beverages.
Thanks, Harry. In today's spirited debate, we whip through the whiskeys to find out the difference between the three main types, Scotch, bourbon, and rye. Whiskey, spelled without an E, is produced in Scotland and Canada, whereas whiskey, spelled with an E, means it's produced in the U.S. and Ireland, and includes Scotch, bourbon, and rye. It's these grains that help define which type of whiskey it will become before it eventually lands among the thousands of bottles on the shelves at your local Total Wine & More. Now, let's talk about Scotch. Scotch is typically made from malted barley, blended with other grains, and that helps give it a little bit of a bite, making it more in an acquired taste. Bourbon must be made from at least 51% corn, produced in the U.S. and aged in new charred oak barrels. The oak gives this brown liquid its signature sweet flavor. And then there's rye, which must be made from at least, yep, you guessed it, 51% rye. Rye is a type of grass in the wheat family that has a spicy, edgier flavor, adding a little extra kick you may not find in a bourbon. For a true test of bourbon versus rye, we recommend you pop into Total Wine, maybe grab a bottle of Scotch while you're here. But to really get to know the differences in Scotch, bourbon, and rye, start by talking to the guides at Total Wine & More, who are more than happy to talk day or night about whiskey, with or without an E.
Thanks to our friends at Total Wine & More for today's A Spirited Debate.
I want to have a few minutes on the Supreme Court taking the immunity trial. Let me just set the table as a lawyer. Don't worry, we usually set our clock by what time during the episode will someone first say, I am not a lawyer, but you needn't be. I'll do the law stuff, which is they took 13 days. There's going to be some explanations about what happened there. They set a schedule that's fast, but not super fast. So we're looking at a late August or early September trial in Chutkin, if nothing else happens. So whether intentionally or not, that he gets a major assist as Trump in the axis he most cares about, delay and time. And since I mentioned the D word, it really struck me just this week, Jack Smith has come in his filings in Mar-a-Lago has come out of the box talking delay, delay, delay. That's what he wants. That's what you can't give him. All right. But a few questions on its implications. So, Robert, if I can start with you, you had a nice contrast on TV between his being totally settled in the campaign, but in a period of near total legal uncertainty. So even, you know, things are going well in terms of delays, but the trial dates, they have to be having some effect, no, on his stamina, on his supporters. What do you see as the impact of this huge legal minefield he continues to have to walk through?
Some of it, Harry, is connected to what we saw last night at the State of the Union. The Republican response was given by Senator Katie Britt of Alabama, who's in her early 40s and is considered a rising star and dynamic. And she gave a very emotive address trying to appeal to people at their kitchen tables, and especially to women who might have some reservations about Trump. Well, those reservations about Trump, whether it's the E. Jean Carroll case, where he was found liable for rape in a civil court, or for different comments he's made about women over the years, as much as Republicans try to put people like Senator Katie Britt out there, what's going to happen in March and April is Trump's payments to Stormy Daniels, the adult film star, are going to be front and center, and he's going to be required by law to sit in that courtroom. So those issues come back to the fore. 2016 comes back to the fore. Michael Cohen, issues about women, infidelity, alleged infidelity, and all of this stuff pops up again and becomes part of the campaign. And so that's putting all the January 6th stuff, which Hugo can get into, aside. But just on the hush money payments, you have this whole revival of an old case because it's coming to trial, and it's the first time Trump is actually going to face a criminal trial.
Let me stick with that and phrase a question for you, Hugo, because you tweeted about a recent poll where, it, again, zeroing in, as I think we have to, on the swing states, where as many as half the voters, as you and Bloomberg reported, said they would be very unwilling or unwilling to vote for him if he was convicted in the criminal cases. That would suggest that the stakes here of delay are phenomenally high. I wonder, though, we've seen time and time again him face crises where it seemed the stakes were high. He actually encountered bad developments, and somehow the MAGA crowd just internalized them, or that's just Donald Trump, and it didn't seem to matter that much. Do you, and this for you also, Tara, see it as huge whether or not a trial goes forward, or is it really something that won't move many voters anyway, given the track record with him?
I think there are three parts to this, and they're all kind of equally complicated. First, with that Bloomberg poll, that was a really interesting poll because it was the first one that I've seen so far that found voters didn't really care which case he was convicted in. A conviction would be fatal for them voting for him. There had previously been a Real Clear Politics poll, and also, I guess, internal Trump polling, where voters seemed to indicate they didn't care as much about the hush money case as opposed to the federal criminal cases brought by Jack Smith. If that is a trend that is going to continue, I think that's going to be a bigger problem for Trump and his campaign than they had previously factored. On that note, the timings and the delays are obviously significant, because if you kind of look at how the legal calendar is going to play out now, I mean, a lot of it's actually on diary, so to speak, right? We're going to trial in New York on March 25 on the hush money case. It'll take 6 weeks. That'll carry us through to May 6th, roughly. But even if the Supreme Court rejects Trump's immunity claim immediately, it's not like Chuck can schedule a trial to go in May. Because if you recall, the effect of the immunity appeal is that the clock on the case has been frozen since December 8th, or whenever he filed that appeal. And so he has roughly 3 months, 2 months and 27 days left on the clock to prepare his defense arguments. So even if SCOTUS ruled by, let's say, the end of the hush money case and said, you know, this is going back to jurisdiction of Judge Chuckin, and Judge Chuckin's like, we're going to trial right away, the earliest he could really set a trial is 3 months later, which is August. Trump's been very clever, and this is my third point, because in the classified documents case, he has suggested to the judge that they go to trial now in August. And if Cannon bites and schedules a trial in August, that will have the effect of boxing out the DC trial completely. And Trump obviously wants to try Cannon as opposed to trying Chuckin, because Cannon has effectively ruled in his favor all the way through this pretrial phase. You know, when he wanted to delay the case, she gave the delays to him. when he wanted to string out the SEPA litigation on which is the rules on how classified information gets introduced at trial, she granted those delays. And part of the theory of the case from the Trump defendants is there's a lot of evidence that was made available to the grand jury during the criminal investigation. For instance, Trump's lawyer, Evan Corcoran's notes that the special counsel's office used to great effect in the indictment. But because that grand jury was in DC and the case is in hand in the Southern District of Florida, the legal theory, at least, is this can all be relitigated. And in terms of the piercing of the attorney-client privilege, which allowed these notes to come in with detailed, really bad allegations of obstruction, you know, the stuff like Evan Corcoran being told to, you know, pluck these documents out. If that all gets relitigated and Trump wins, Cannon, as the ultimate arbiter of which evidence can be introduced at trial, I think could severely gut Trump's case. So it may be that Trump goes to trial only in the documents case before the election, and Cannon reduces the scope of that case significantly, which is a really big deal for Trump and would be the most astute lawfare weaponization that he could have done. And I think that's a really big deal.
Well, let me ask you for the closeout, which is this. The Supreme Court has given him the great gift of time, and they will rule against him in immunity. It might be with a remand as soon as late May, as late as late June. We've been talking about the impact of some of these trials. Does a court ruling of that nature kind of serve as a body blow in the same way some of these polls might? Or since it's just a legal ruling and the Supreme Court has abysmal public approval rating itself, would that not be an important political event?
The Supreme Court ruling on immunity or the actual cases?
Yeah, and you can assume for purpose of the question, they'll rule against him on the merits.
Right. And let's hope, for goodness sakes, you never know. But it seems pretty cut and dry on that, you know, we don't have a king and he can't have absolute immunity. They may come back and say there's some limited immunity, but it does not apply to what he's talking about or actions out of office. I think that for most people, it's too many layers to get there to say, oh, well, the Supreme Court now finally said that he doesn't have immunity. I mean, I think it's pretty obvious to most people that a president cannot have absolute immunity and can do anything they want. I think that political argument has already been made. It's just common sense. In America, we don't have a king. We don't have a monarch. You don't get to do whatever the hell you want when you're president of the United States. And the fact that Trump thinks that way is baked into the cake of why he's dangerous moving forward. So for people, I don't think that the Supreme Court's ruling reaffirming kind of what all Americans already know and understand is going to make a difference. I think to Hugo's point, the polling shows that a conviction is what will make the difference. Because now, if you respect the rule of law, you respect our institutions, you respect the judiciary, the guy's now a convicted felon. So you have to make a decision. Are you comfortable casting a ballot for someone who is convicted of a felony? And, you know, I would hope that most Americans would say no, compared to Joe Biden, who he was not a felon, didn't incite an insurrection, doesn't want to be a dictator on day one, doesn't want to revamp the entire federal government so that it's an arm of retribution for you in absolute power. These are all things that I think average Americans, once they start paying attention to it, are going to say, I'm not comfortable with that. Let's hope so, because this is going to be a very, very close election. And the fact that it's going to be close is a whole different discussion and alarming in and of itself, and says a lot about our society.
But here's the rub, right? Just on the conviction point. We talk a lot about when the trials are going to start, but I think people sometimes forget that these trials last weeks and weeks and weeks.
Right.
You know, 6 weeks in New York. I mean, we're estimating, 8 to 10 weeks in the DC case, maybe 8 to 10 weeks in the documents case.
In Fulton County, forget about it.
Well, forget about that. But the length of those trials could mean we don't get a conviction, even if the documents case were to go to trial before the election. There's no guarantee we'll get a conviction before the election. And so if there's no conviction other than the one hush money trial, and, you know, some of those are misdemeanors, people, I think, in their minds conceive of it as a weak case. That's the one thing that the Trump campaign is trying to do, is muddy the cases together so that the New York AG civil trial sounds like the hush money trial and people will get confused and they can't, you know, separate these out. Then if that's the only conviction we have before the election, I think that also changes the calculus in a really big way, because people, you know, maybe to the credit of the American people, they're like, I'm not going to make a determination until a jury has found it guilty.
that's what makes what the Supreme Court has done by taking up this case so egregious. They literally have given him a form of immunity without giving him immunity by the gift of delay, because you can't tell me that they don't know that by doing this, that it changes the timeline here. And that is absolutely infuriating, because they didn't have to do this. They could have just left the decision, or they could have expedited it and made the decision, because it's going to be so obvious that they don't think he has absolute immunity, and not push it all these weeks. They did it in Bush v. Gore. They can do whatever they want. They could rush it, but they haven't.
And maybe we'll learn they tried, but some weren't there. Okay, there's an end for now. This itself is a whole other discussion. We are out of time. Unfortunately, not even time for our much beloved Talking Five feature. Thank you so much to Bob and Hugo and Tara. Hope to see you again soon. It really is the case that we're at a pivot point and everything ends and starts with this week. So thanks for being with us on such a momentous juncture. We are out of time. Thank you so much, Tara, Hugo, and Robert. And thank you very much, listeners, for tuning in to Talking Feds. If you like what you've heard, please tell a friend to subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts or wherever they get their podcasts. And please take a moment to rate and review this podcast. You can also subscribe to us on YouTube, where we post full episodes, talking books, and bonus video content. You can follow us on Twitter at TalkingFedsPod, and you can look to see our latest offerings on Patreon. Talking Feds is a completely independent production, so if you like the work we do and are inclined to support the show, joining our Patreon is the best way to do it. And you can now leave voicemails with your questions for me and our guests, whether it's for Talking Five or general questions about the inner workings of the legal system for our sidebar segments. All you have to do is call 727-279-5339 and leave a voice message. That's 727-279-5339. And you can still also, of course, email us your questions at questions@talkingfeds.com. Thanks for tuning in, and don't worry. As long as you need answers, the feds will keep talking. Talking Feds is produced by Catherine Devine. Associate producer Meredith McCabe. Sound engineering by Matt McArdle. Our research producer is Zeke Reed. Rosie Don Griffin and David Lieberman are our contributing writers. Production assistance by Akshaj Turbailu, and our music by the amazing Philip Glass. Thanks very much to Claudia Rankin for explaining the Family and Medical Leave Act. Happy birthday to Mike. Talking Feds is a production of DeLito LLC. I'm Harry Littman. Talk to you later.